Welcome to Older Women Live. I'm Rosemary Wally. This series features women's voices from across the globe and revisits over a decade of interviews I've done with a variety of people involved in social justice issues. Older Women Live provides background to contemporary issues like age, race, gender, and the impact of globalization on women's lives. This is a special broadcast for AMARC's Communicating Development International audio series. In this episode, we explore difficulties around food access in remote Indigenous communities in Manitoba, Canada, and the Western Highlands of Guatemala. We hear from two women who are affecting change in these communities and raising awareness of these issues in Canada. In this episode, you'll hear my conversation with Liz Ballantyne Jackson, a retired teacher and mother of two from Ottawa, who volunteers with the Guatemala Stove Project. The Guatemala Stove Project provides safer and more efficient cooking methods for small, isolated communities in Guatemala. I also spoke with Dr. Shirley Thompson, a professor in the Natural Resources Institute at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg. Dr. Thompson described her research about food security in 14 Indigenous communities in the remote areas of northern Manitoba. We start with Liz Ballantyne Jackson discussing her role in the Guatemala Stove Project. Liz, can you tell us what the Guatemala Stove Project is?
Well, the Stove Project is a small NGO that's volunteer-driven. It's a grassroots organization that's based in the Perth and Ottawa areas. And the main purpose of the Stove Project is to fundraise, raise funds, and finance the building of improved cooking stoves in Guatemala, a specific region of Guatemala, which is the Western Highlands.
Why do you need to do that? What was the problem?
Well, I'll explain that from a global perspective, because this is an issue that affects communities and women and people worldwide. It's estimated that there are around 3 billion people in the world who cook still over open fires. They cook their meals over a fire with open flames, either inside or outside of their homes. That's 3 billion people worldwide who are affected by this situation, and up to 1.9 million people a year die from the effects of the smoke, the toxic smokes that are in a home. So that produces all sorts of health issues. Children and women in particular are affected because they are the ones who are around the cooking fire most. So there's high incidences of emphysema, pneumonia, asthma, cataracts. It's a global issue that is finally getting some recognition.
I met Liz Ballantyne Jackson in a hotel lobby, actually, in Ottawa. She was sitting there and it looked as though she was waiting for somebody. But I'd previously picked up a leaflet, and the leaflet described the Guatemala Stove Project and it mentioned her name. And when I looked at the name tag of the woman that was sitting there on a couch in the lobby in the hotel, it was Elizabeth Ballantyne Jackson. So I asked her whether I could interview her, and she said she was very willing to be interviewed. Like me, Liz Ballantyne Jackson was a retired teacher, and she'd chosen as her volunteer work to get involved with this group, this very small group that was doing very, very practical hands-on stuff around the Stove Project. And I really like small groups like that, and very practical, just small practical projects really appealed to me a lot. And this project, I thought it was so imaginative and so important, so absolutely fundamental to development.
Just recently, there was an alliance formed called the Global Alliance for Clean Cook Stoves. This is an initiative of the Clinton Foundation. Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton have united with the United Nations. They're trying to bring international attention to the situation. And our organization works specifically to combat the problem in one very specific small region of Guatemala and Central America.
There must be also a lot of accidents, presumably.
Yes, that's a really serious issue. small children in particular, but women as well. If you've ever had an opportunity to see one of these open fires, there's flames coming out the sides beside the fire. Traditionally, the women in Guatemala wear lovely long hand-woven skirts. They brush against the flames, they catch on fire. Often there are pots of water heating on the fire. They tip over, they burn children. There's a lot of issues. It's a very serious problem, but there is a solution, and it's not too expensive from our perspective, but from the perspective of someone who lives in poverty, the solution is fairly complicated.
Can you tell us a bit about these communities?
The communities that we work in are, as I said, located in the western highlands of Guatemala, quite a distance from the capital city, Guatemala City. They're in a very mountainous region. The people live in small villages up in the highlands. Most of the people are Mayan families. The Mayan people and indigenous people in general were marginalized during the colonial period of history throughout Central and South America. And so they've been historically marginalized. So these people live in very small communities without the kinds of resources and infrastructure that we take for granted as Canadians and North Americans. So they're living in small communities that often don't have road access. Their homes are small and very modest, often made out of adobe blocks or cement blocks with tin roofs. Because this is a mountainous region, it's quite cold during the winter, and so the cooking fires are inside the homes, which heats the home to a point, but it also causes the problems of indoor air pollution. And if you go into these homes, you can see the black tarry substances that are on the ceiling, and studies have been done to measure the particulate matter that is in the air, and it's causing all sorts of health issues for the families that live in those homes. They are communities that do their best to work together. They have issues of sanitation. They need latrines. They need access to water. They need improved education. And again, they need the improved cooking method. And that's the focus of our group. We focus on improved cooking stoves.
Can you describe this improved stove?
There are lots of different types of improved cooking stoves, and the Global Alliance that I mentioned before, their mandate is to promote a more factory-produced stove that is portable and can be produced in a factory. The stove that we make is very specific to this region, and it's quite popular in the region where we work. And it is a very permanent structure, so they're built in homes of people who, for the most part, own their own land. It's made from cement and cement blocks, and it's mortared together. It has a firebox inside that's insulated with sand and small fire bricks. The important part is that it's vented outside through the roof with a chimney. As I said, it has a small firebox, but because it's well insulated and closed off, one of the important things about these stoves is they require about 50% of the amount of wood that a traditional open fire uses. So once a family can start using their improved cooking stove, they don't have to purchase as much wood, or they don't have to go and chop down as much wood in the neighboring forest. So it's a win-win situation. It's good for the family health-wise. It's also good for the environment because it is wood-friendly. It takes less wood to cook a meal on one of these stoves.
And it sounds as though the technology is very, very simple.
Exactly. And that is one of the good things about this stove. You don't need any power tools to make it. It can be made with materials purchased locally. The bricks are made locally, so that creates economy in the area, creates business. We employ local masons who are trained in building the stoves of this design. The materials have to often be carried from a road up to a mile, half a kilometer or kilometer away from the roads, so all the materials have to be carried in. Often they're built in rooms that don't have electricity or very limited electricity, but they can all be made with materials that can be brought into the community. So they are very efficient, and the design is quite popular. It's also a stove that is more than just a stove. It's sort of like a kitchen countertop or like an island in the middle of the house or the room. And because it's a fairly large surface, there's a metal plate or a plancha, it's called, on top of the stove. And a woman can do her cooking on the stove in pots and pans and frying pans, but she can also put a pot of water on the edge, and that water can heat all day. So once she has hot water, she can use that for washing clothes, she can use that for washing hair or their children's faces or hands. So it's more than just a cooking implement. It helps sanitation and hygiene. It's, as I said, it's a win-win situation. The women really value these cooking stoves because they've gone from cooking on the ground, often with their child on their back. And so the mother and the child were bending over the flames, getting the smoke in their eyes. And now the stove is elevated up to a meter off the floor. The woman can stand upright and doesn't have an aching back anymore. I hear nothing but praise from the women who receive these stoves, because for them it's like being given this wonderful appliance. Even though from a Canadian or a North American perspective it doesn't look like much, I like to see it as the first step up out of poverty. It's the first step. Once a woman can change her cooking habits, she also spends less time cooking. If you can imagine just cooking over a small open flame, how long it takes to switch pots and move your things around, she can now prepare a meal in half the time using half the wood in a much cleaner, sanitary way.
How much do these stoves cost?
That's a good question. From our perspective as a fundraising group, we ask a family or a donor to donate $200 or $225 towards the building of a stove. That helps us with our costs here in Canada for financing the program. The costs in Guatemala are, the money that's sent there is roughly $170 to $180 for the materials and the employment of a mason to build the stove and the delivery. Delivery costs can be high because the materials are trucked from a town up into the mountains. Costs from our perspective is not high, but from a family that is, you know, making only the equivalent of $1 or $2 a day per person for all of their expenses, it's way out of reach. But we're able to finance the building of stoves for about $200 per stove.
How many stoves have you managed to donate so far?
The stove project has fundraised over the past 10 or more years about the equivalent of about 4,000 stoves. We had a really good fundraising year last year, and we were able to build close to 400 stoves and do some emergency funding, because last year was a very difficult year in Guatemala. There were a lot of floods and landslides, and we had some requests for funding for emergency aid. So even though we donated money towards emergency aid, we were also able to fund close to 400 stoves. So that was a very good year for us. We're a group of Canadians. We're all volunteers. None of us are employed by the Stove Project. We have other jobs, other activities that we do, but we come together and we coordinate the activities in Guatemala. We do fundraising events, and we get a lot of satisfaction out of helping families in Guatemala this way.
When did this project start? How long have you been going?
The project started in around 1999, I guess, with Tom Clark, who's the founder. Tom lives in Perth, Ontario. It's a very small town, about an hour from Ottawa. He's a carpenter by trade and was traveling in Central America several times in his life. And I guess in the 1990s, he met up with a young Guatemalan, a Quiche Maya fellow, who was coordinator or director of an indigenous health organization called SEDEC. And Tom, who loves to build things, was able to build some stoves with Jose at that time. He learned how to build stoves from an elder who was a mason and had been developing a different style of stove that was popular in Central America. So Tom helped build a few stoves that year, returned to Perth, talked to people there, got people interested. The next year he returned with a group of five or six people. They built another 30 stoves. And from there, the group just grew and more people got interested. I think what's appealing to people is that they can help out with the project and actually see the results of their work. When we make donations to big NGOs or aid agencies, we have to trust them, and we send our money off, and you know, most of the time the money's well spent. But if you join a small group like ours, you can actually travel to the country, meet the people who are recipients of your efforts and your donation. It's a project where people like to be actively involved in development work. When a person donates for a stove, they will receive a picture of a family beside the stove, and you actually do see the results. And the donation doesn't just help the mother or the one or two people, it helps the whole family. Our motto is build a stove, change the future. And by building a stove, that family gets improved health, and the mother has more time, and things just start rolling from there. I think it's a really good way to affect change in developing countries.
Now, do you have a website, Liz, that we could log on to?
Yes, the Stove Project does have a website. It's www.GuatemalaStoveProject.org. It's just one big long word, GuatemalaStoveProject.org. And if people are interested in learning a little bit more about the global issue of indoor air pollution and the problems worldwide, they could go to the site for the Global Alliance for Clean Cook Stoves. That's HTTP and then cleancookstoves.org. And that gives you a lot of background information about the issue globally. And then our website would give you information about the regional context of that.
I was lucky to attend a workshop given by Dr. Thompson in Ottawa at a women's conference. I've always been very interested in food because it's such a basic need and such a basic right that people have. And I found the workshop to be very, very well organised and so well presented. And I was really, very touched by what she had to say about the lack of food. Here in Canada, we think it's a rich country. We think everybody eats, but everybody doesn't. When you're thinking of remote in Canada, you're really thinking of remote. And that these people are struggling on with no infrastructure. She mentions that some of them are living off the grid. They can't even use a basic cell phone. So they're totally on their own. And what they need is just the same as what everybody else needs. But as you'll hear in the interview, food is not available to them as it is to those that live in the south.
Can you tell us, Shirley, about the Aboriginal northern communities in Manitoba?
There's a number of northern Manitoba communities that lack any roads. They have no road access except for possibly a month during the winter. This window of opportunity for winter roads has been reduced due to climate change and gets later and later and shorter almost every year. These communities, many of them lack running water, so they'll have cisterns. Many of the houses lack flush toilets. So there's a real infrastructure issue. There is a shortage of housing, a severe shortage of housing in the communities, and not a lot of facilities. I think of Garden Hill and Wasagamac, where they have the community on one island and the store and the airport on another island. And so for people to actually get food into their homes, they have to take probably three different means of transportation. And many of these people can't even afford one, like a car or a boat. And in the winter, they take a skidoo. And during breakup time, you're risking your life actually crossing just to get your food or to take a plane to have a health checkup in a medical facility. Some of these are very large communities of several thousand. No First Nations community in Manitoba has paved roads. So there's simply not the funding for paved roads, which creates all sorts of dust and gravel problems and eats away at the cars that they have. I think there's four off-grid communities. The electricity is generated by diesel, so it's very limited and very problematic as well for environmental spills. Many of these communities have had oil spills as a result, but it limits the ability of the community to build infrastructure, to heat their homes, to build homes, and really curtails economic development.
So what about internet and television and phones?
It depends. Some communities have good internet access, a satellite access at least, but others have no satellite access. Around Nelson House, it stops. So South Indian Lake, Lynn Lake, Leaf Rapids, Brochet, you cannot use your cell phone there. So they have no satellite access and very limited to the school and the health center internet access. There's a lot of communities, and they include Oji-Cree, Cree, Anishinaabe or Ojibwe, and Dene communities, which are the farthest north, which are known as caribou hunters more. So there's a variety of language, a lot of cultural heritage in these communities, just an absolute lack of infrastructure and economic development.
What's the situation regarding food and food security?
Our survey of 14 communities, which had more than 500 households, showed severe food insecurity, high rates of severe food insecurity. 75% of households were food insecure. In some communities, like South Indian Lake, it was 100% of households. The fly-in communities were much worse. The food costs, we did a food cost in the stores, and there's a monopoly in these communities where there is one store, and the costs are 2 to 3 times to 5 times as much for nutritious products like vegetables, fruit, milk. So you have $15 milk. You have 4 tomatoes for $12. We have pitchers of 10 pounds of potatoes for $22. It's a staple of the community is potatoes. Normally you can buy 10 pounds of potatoes for $3, $4. That's 5, 6 times.
When we're talking about food insecurity, we're talking about hunger.
Yes. So when we knocked on doors and asked people questions around food security, a scientific survey, and we asked 18 questions. We asked really, really difficult questions, hard to ask, harder to answer. Do you run out of food and have no money to buy more? Do you go without food for a day because you have no food and no money to buy more? Do your children go without food for a day because you have no food and no money to buy food? So very difficult questions. And one of the subgroups we interviewed were fishermen who were bragging, and they were good fishermen. They were the best fishermen, and they had such great swagger. And then we asked these food security questions. You know, here they are trying to work. There's lots of barriers. And they looked at us and said, yes, every month that happens. Every month we run out of food. Our kids can't eat for a day because we run out. When shoes are $200, when milk is $15, when you have such a limited income, there is no way that anyone here can feed their family.
What kind of income would a family of four have?
Well, there's massive structural unemployment. So the only employer in most of these communities is the health center, and often that's non-local people. There's is the school and the band office. So very limited employment opportunities, which creates lots of unemployment. We tried to apply on behalf of schools and health centers, employment for youth, thinking, let's get them working as food activists in these communities. So we applied for all these government programs that are advertised on the internet, and we thought, we're going to at least get one. And the frustration that builds when you find out there's really no jobs behind this. So we weren't able to get actually one, after applying to at least 5 places, we weren't able to get one sponsored placement for these 10 communities. So there are very limited job opportunities for First Nations, and it starts at youth. And there aren't youth employment programs that are substantive for these communities, and it's very problematic.
The people are living on social assistance?
Many. I would say the great majority thereof.
And how much is that, just to give us an idea?
For a single person, it's $220.
So it's $220, but milk is, you said, $15 a carton.
Yes, that's right.
It's $220 a month.
It's $220 a month.
What are the people doing to feed themselves?
Lots of subsistence activities are occurring when people can. The difficulty is that often there's not spades. There's no spades in these communities. There's no shovels. There's one rototiller, a recent government program which gave one rototiller to the whole community to share. This one program was a Northern Healthy Food Initiative, and it possibly gave $2 per capita. It was very limited funding for people to garden. And the store, the local store, doesn't sell seeds. It doesn't sell plants. So if it's not provided in some way through some programming, there's no way that they can access plants. So the Northern Store does not provide that opportunity and work for the people. And, you know, it would probably see that in competition with their selling food. The Aboriginal Diabetes Initiative went out and bought fishing nets, which actually was very good. It was ice fishing nets. They reviewed the practice, and they found that one fishing net would feed 20 families, so that it was really providing a much-needed source of protein throughout the winter, and people were sharing quite a lot. Now, there's a lot of structural barriers for actually using the fish for school programming and for programming in the community, but at least if you're a non-commercial fisherman, you can share within your family and share with other people locally.
When you talk about structural barriers, what do you mean exactly, Shirley?
The one employment opportunity in these communities is fishing, and that's self-employment. So people have to buy their motor and buy their boat, which is very expensive in these communities. Those also have freight charges. The barriers are that because they're in fly-in or remote communities with awful roads, awful infrastructure, no processing. There's no processing plant in northern Manitoba that does anything but put it on ice. So here you are flying out and freighting fish when, in the end, if it was filleted, it would be much more lucrative. The freight costs would be reduced and the value would be much higher, or allowed for smoked products to be sold. But because they don't have a license for processing fish, they're not able to do it in these communities. You have to have a special license from the Freshwater Fish Marketing Corporation. The other aspect is you can have a commercial fisher's license, and many do in these communities, but you can't actually sell it unless you have a vendor's license. So no store in that community, no restaurant in that community can actually sell local fish, or even a sports fishing lodge could not sell local fish. It could not serve local fish and charge for it.
The people are not only victims of lack of infrastructure and poverty, but they're also victims of government red tape.
People are afraid of having the little bit they have taken away from them. So the schools will not serve wild meat, even though they don't have enough money to buy a good lunch program diet. And there's so much diabetes in these communities. It's the highest rate in all of Canada. So, yes, these structural barriers, these are communities where nobody goes, hardly anybody goes to, but the public health officer comes regularly and threatens to shut them down. He asks for the boxes, to see the boxes for the fish, for the meat, and if not, he will shut them down. So there's a real market economy mentality where things have to be inspected in a federal food facility, and for fish, that's only in the south. So it would have to be flown out and processed and flown back up again.
You mean that they would fly it out using all that gas and everything down to a southern fish plant, clean it and fillet it, and then fly it back? Well, I mean, how much would that end up costing then?
A lot. So we're actually trying to start a direct buying with the local fishermen, and they're so keen. And we've recently had, you know, this fish processing plant, which is merely an ice plant, really, because that's all it's licensed to do, had a grand opening of it and had great invitations, and they invited all the political people, and none of them came. And we came, and we're trying to link them to one fish vendor and start to sell it, to have a kind of Know Your Fisherman campaign where people will pay good prices and the prices will go to the fisherman rather than the middleman, which happens now.
Why don't they have permanent food inspectors in the north somewhere?
They really do have to look at how they regulate and have culturally attuned regulation and fish processors. Somehow they really don't see outside the market system and the federal food processing. They know the rules and they apply them, not considering cultural aspects, and that food security is a much higher risk than any possible disease if the food is cooked properly, right? So the highest risk is food insecurity, which is in these communities 80, 85, 90, 100%.
Well, this sounds like colonialism at its absolute worst. It's as though you're really describing some 18th century system here.
And it is very difficult to get past these rules and figure it out. It does shut people down. When we talk to the fishermen, they are barely making a living. And if they don't get their money when they give the fish, they can't go out the next day because they have no money for gas. And gas is very expensive in these communities. It's $1.80, $2. It's much higher than here. So they're paying much higher rates for gas because it has to be trucked up there, freighted up. So it's so expensive to live in these communities. As one person said, it's cheaper to live in southern France than to live in northern Manitoba communities. That's been my experience.
So we're talking about, yes, $2 a litre for gas.
That's right.
What kind of wildlife do they have up there that they could potentially hunt were it not for the government's policies?
So there are moose, and they do hunt moose. They just can't sell moose, and you can't share it in public. You can't share wild meat in public that hasn't been inspected in a federal food facility. So you can't share it at the band office. You can't share it in the school system. So you can't actually provide even the hospital, the elders' home, the people who really desire this food, this is that is culturally appropriate for them. There's caribou in Brochet, and now actually the Country Foods Program in Nelson House, they have a program where they pay people to go and hunt and fish. You're not allowed to actually sell it, but they share it. They've bought freezers, and they provide it individually to elders. And they've actually adopted a herd of caribou and are trying to reintroduce them to a certain pair of land. So they see sustainable hunting and fishing and have certain practices in place to make that happen. Instead of actually destroying the wildlife, they're actually trying to reintroduce it. This program should be in every community because we found that program was statistically significant. That community had the lowest food insecurity. People were able to eat culturally appropriate food. They didn't have severe food insecurity. And when you ask them why is this community so much better? And they would say the Country Foods Program. So out of that community, 1,500 out of 2,500 use the Country Foods Program. And you can use it for weddings. Like, people can't afford these big events, right? Unless you get some support. And if these communities are extremely poor for Canada, it's hard to believe the type of infrastructure, that people's incomes are so low, so much lower than the Canadian public.
Who sponsors the Country Foods Program? Is it a local initiative?
It is. Now, there are other places in Canada that have similar programs, but this was through the band. They have a fund from the Northern Flood Agreement because they were flooded out because of Manitoba Hydro with lots of impacts, which has affected local geese flying. So geese no longer fly to that area because the water runs the other way and much faster. They actually reverse the flow of the river. What happened is they have to travel far distances for geese hunting. But they do that in a very organized manner. They will take the train to Churchill and organize a hunt there and come back with a freezer car of goose at the appropriate time. And they use lakes outside that have not been impacted by Manitoba hydro flooding. But so many First Nations communities are impacted by hydro flooding and see that as compromising, you know, reducing fish stocks, where the levels always fluctuating up and down results, especially the timing of it, results in the eggs not being able to hatch. So the fish lay the eggs, and then the water level goes down and they're exposed. And they've seen dramatic decreases of fish, and they regularly mention this, and nothing changes. All the older people talk about all the eggs they used to collect, the birds' eggs. Lots of different berries. People are very big on berries and different medicines. And people used to plant lots of gardens as well.
Do they still do it now?
In many areas, it's being reestablished. Yes, it's skipped a few generations, and now it's being reintroduced back. When the ground's frozen in some of these communities in July and end of June, the growing season is very short. That's why country foods programs and wild foods and fish, all the kinds of different fish, tulipy, trout, besides pickerel, the white fish, everything that used to be eaten And now the only market that's available that pays enough to at least provide some income for the fishermen is pickerel. So really the only thing that they can freight out without losing money is pickerel. So the problem then becomes that everything else has to be wasted because they can't sell it locally, they can't give it away, and people have been charged for giving it away too. So as a result, every other kind of fish, which have beautiful tastes, and people love the jackfish more than pickerel in these communities, but most of it's wasted because people can't afford to fish it.
What's the role of the politicians that are supposed to be protecting our welfare and looking after us and representing us, either in Winnipeg, the provincial level, or in Ottawa? What are they doing, and what's their relationship with the community?
Recently, the federal program called Food Mail has been re-engineered to be called Nutrition North. And it's very problematic in that rather than a government agency, Canada Post, providing that service, now a private company, which is the Northern Store, which has the monopoly in the North, is given the sole contract to make a monopoly even larger. It's actually created all these regulatory barriers and isn't working with northern communities to allow sustainable livelihoods. It's in fact creating such barriers that sustainable livelihoods are not possible in these communities.
Northern Store is obviously a for-profit company, isn't it?
It is. So
who owns it?
The Hudson Bay Company in the Northwest. It was then called the Northern Store, and now it's bought out by an American company.
They've fallen victim to globalization.
Yes. Our concern is that this wasn't done for the benefit of northern communities, but it was done because of corporate lobbying and corporate connections. This is not going to benefit northern communities. In fact, it's going to make it far worse. And this has to be renegotiated and reviewed.
Yeah, so it sounds as though the politicians are really not at all assuming their roles and responsibilities for the people.
No, absolutely not. So the North has been the frontier and lots of money has been drained out of it. And yes, and very little is put back. And in fact, nothing in terms of infrastructure.
In this episode, you heard Liz Ballantyne Jackson and Dr. Shirley Thompson. This segment is part of an audio series highlighting the importance of communication as a major tool for development. It has been produced with the support of the World Association of Community Broadcasters and the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. Older Women Live is produced by Michelle Macklin and me, Rosemary Wally. Older Women Live is a production of Aging, Communication, Technology and CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, Canada. Music in this episode by Poddington Bear. This research was supported by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. You can hear more episodes by subscribing on iTunes or visiting our website at actproject.ca.